budget to drive up from Smelly West London, which is very hot and sticky at the moment, and to drive into the Cotswolds on an evening like this. So it's nice to be with you, and thank you for having me. So I need to speak for maybe about 45 minutes, something like that, probably with a few little pauses for, hear what you think, or get you prepared, sort of thing. And then I'm sure we'll leave plenty of time for questions and comments, so that you get a chance, because I think for these kinds of subjects that Simon's already alluded to, this is a controversial area in the church at the moment, and there'll be, I'm sure, a range of views in this room. I'm not going to pretend to do the sort of the impartial academic thing of saying, well, some people think this and some people think that, and really the truth is somewhere in the middle. Partly because I don't think that would be honest about my own. I've got my own views about this, and so are you going to hear them? But at the same time, I hope I will also put them across in a way which is open-handed and sort of giving you the chance to think this through for yourself. Because the point of it is that really to think this through for yourself, both in terms of theologically and in terms of your faith, but also in terms of practically and pastorally, how do we live this out in our church, in our community, in our friendships and relationships with the people around us, and for some of us, very possibly, how we live this out in our own lives. So that's the government health warning for you. I apologise for some reason, and despite Rich's fantastic effort, the PowerPoint has an attractive yellow tinge to it. So just to say, that's not the way I designed the PowerPoint. You like pretty yellow background. Apologies for that. Hopefully you'll still be able to see the material. Because I'm an academic, so I mean, as Simon said, I teach at St Malice College in London, and I teach ethics, in fact, so this is within my sort of academic area of teaching. I would say that teaching ethics means my job is to try and make people more moral people, which, in my opinion, is a very challenging and demanding role. Well, I do the best with the raw material. But obviously, a lot depends on the church, which they are. So because I am an academic, I feel like I have to give you a handout, otherwise you won't have learned anything, unless it's something you can take home. And also, of course, like all good academics, the handout's part of the book. So I apologise for those of you who are giving a slight sort of bringing back, school and university nightmares or whatever. But I hope that will, if there are folks here who would like to think through this more, to go deeper, to do some reading, I hope those resources will be helpful. And for you, just to pick out a couple of those on the head, and then I'm going to put them up on the screen. And this is my modest contribution to debate. And as it happens, I've got some copies with me here tonight. If you'd like to get hold of one, The Only Way to Ethics is the title, which is quite neat. I didn't come up with the title, but it's a nice one, isn't it? Or did you not watch that often with me? It might be a bit too Washed and Waiting is a beautiful book. Any of you come across this book at all? By a guy called Wes Hill. He's an American writer, and he is gay and celibate, writing from a Christian point of view, saying this is the way I've chosen to live my life in accordance with the Bible's teachings, and obviously as a costly way of life, but also saying that actually there are blessings to that and positives to that as well. So it's an honest book, and if you're kind of thinking through, okay, there are gay people I know, being Christians or even non-Christians of course, that I want to support them and really learn how to do that well, that's a great book to read, because it's going to say this is what it's like from the inside experience. So I commend that one achieved that for that reason. This one is helpful, The End of Sexual Identity, Janelle Williams Paris. She's an anthropologist rather than a theologian or a biblical scholar, but she's looking at where did that whole concept of sexual orientation come from? Why do we use that concept today? As you may well know, this might be something we'll touch on as we go through tonight. The whole idea that some people are gay, some people are straight, some people are bisexual, and so the idea of sexual orientation is actually a very new concept. Now, same-sex relationships, same-sex sex, has always been around. I mean, there's not as much as we've got records of. I mean, there's plenty of it around in ancient Greece and Rome and so on. It's not as if that's new, but the idea that some people are inherently oriented towards sexual attraction to people of the same sex, that is actually very new as a concept. So she explores that and unpacks that and says, what does this mean, where does that come from? So that's quite an interesting book to look at from that point of view.
The final resource I wanted to, just from an anthropological
As far as I can remember, I don't think she looks at that. It's very anthropological, yeah. What Richard is saying is deep at the front, but you bought me by so sorry. And the final one I want to mention is the website livingout.org. Now, any of you come across this one already? One or two of you, obviously Rich has. This website is set up by me and some friends. And again, much like Wes Hill, the idea is in this website that we're folk who are writing from our own experience. So I've already alluded to the fact that an academic and teacher in the area of ethics. But for me, the subject of same-sex relationships and homosexuality is very much part of my own story as well. And I'll tell you a bit more about that as we go through. So the idea of living out is to say, here we are as Christians who are same-sex attracted or same-sex oriented, but we're also living in accordance with the teaching of the church, the idea that sex is only between a woman and a man within marriage. And that's a good way for us to live. Now, because obviously if you notice in the media, the way that it tends to be portrayed is if somebody comes out to a Christian or if somebody is a gay Christian, then that's a recipe for disaster. It's an accident waiting to happen because the church is so nasty and homophobic that if they come out to people, or especially if they speak in a same-sex relationship, then they'll be judged, they'll be ostracised, and so on. And that's not been our experience at all. So we set this site up to kind of say, actually, there's a better story to be told. Of course, some of those horrific stories are real and true. You know, we've got to hear those. Sorry, some of those. It sounds like I can say some of those aren't true. Of course, those stories are some of the truth. Those things do happen. There is homophobia within the church. But there are also many churches, and hopefully you would either be one of them, or this would be one of the steps towards you increasingly being one of them, where gay people are welcome, accepted, loved, just as who they are. That's kind of been our experience, and so we're trying to talk about that experience. So those are a few resources for you. What I'll do now is just tell you a little bit about my story, therefore, because I've kind of hinted about that, and hopefully piqued your interest. I mean, it's always, when you're preaching, you say, let me tell you about something else. Let me tell you something that happened to me, and then you can see all of the congregation who did it for start to sit up a little bit. They know me and they'd like to hear what's happened to them. So for me, in my own life, I became a Christian when I was about 16, and quite soon after that, I realised I was gay. That right at the time when all my friends were becoming interested in girls, and I was more interested in some of them. Really, it was a bit awkward, isn't it? There was sort of saying, "If you see her, she's really fit, isn't she?" And I was like, "Oh yeah," staring dreamily into his eyes. "Oh yeah," but I didn't. At that point, I didn't tell anyone about that, so I didn't really know what to make of it. And I was in a church which I'll kind of summarise the view about sex in that church. Sex is good. It's a good gift from God, but sex is for marriage. Okay? Now, this will probably sound reasonably familiar so far. Some of you? Son's looking nervous. Alright, well, I'm going to start a bit further back with you, maybe. Sex is a good gift. It's a gift of God, it's not a bad thing, it's not icky, it's not sinful, sex is a godly thing, but it's a gift given by God for a particular purpose, for a particular context, namely the joining of two people into a lifelong covenant. They didn't use the word covenant in this church, by the way, because it was a youth church. We were all young people. And I think we probably had to do quite a lot of teaching about sex in this particular youth church. You know, I was in this youth church, I was a youth worker, I did sex talk with young people. Then of course now I'm growing up, I find I'm still doing the sex talk with adults, and I've discovered they need it just as much as the youth, you know. So but that was the context in which we were. So we were it was good at talking about sex openly and honestly, but the message was a very clear one, that sex is for marriage. And here's the third part of it was, therefore, you should wait for marriage. Okay? Sex is good, it's for marriage, implication, wait. Okay? Now, can anyone tell me what the strengths, let's be interactive, as I promised to you, what are the possible strengths of that teaching? I'll get to think about other potential challenges or difficulties in a minute, but what are the strengths of that?
It's biblical.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I like you. Yeah, but there's a real biblical foundation for that, namely that sex is good. You know, God saw all that He had made, and it's very good, and that's sex is part of that. He says, you know, be fruitful and multiply. You can't do that without sex. Although some theologians have tried that over the years, have tried to explain how you could have, how this couldn't possibly include sex, because that only came in with sin. No, sex is pre-sin, it is a good thing, and yet it is for a particular purpose, and we'll maybe look at biblical texts, so you've got a great answer. Some more. Strength.
You said it there, but it happened to me. Affirms of goodness.
Affirms of goodness. Absolutely, it's not saying sex is evil or sex is a fallen thing. Very good. Yeah,
increasing self-control and dignity.
Yes, it's saying you actually have a choice. As young people, because in our sex education lesson, I mean, I remember we had the sex education lessons were all about safe sex. You know, and I think at the end of one of them, and this is in a church school, interestingly, at the end of one of them, as an afterthought, the teacher sort of said, and of course you don't have to do it, you know, it's not compulsory, but the assumption was that we would be doing it. So, but actually, I love what you're saying there, the fact that we have a choice is a matter of dignity. It values us as created beings in the image of God, rational, you know, and those kinds of things. That's
what it is. Producing children and marriage is a framework for bringing up children.
Brilliant. Yes. So marriage, children are a project, aren't they? And a challenge and many other things inside. And the best place for that to happen is in a stable, committed framework. One of the big questions of today when it comes to same-sex relationships, of course, is why can't that committed, stable relationship be a same-sex one just as much as it can be as an opposite-sex one? But certainly that was part of it. You know, sex produces children, this is the right thing. Yeah. What else? Any others? I'm sure there's more. Well, let's leave it there for now. Are there any possible challenges or difficulties with that teaching? Sex is good, it's for marriage, so wait for marriage. What are the possible pitfalls there?
Some people might rush into marriage and not really have a
very important. Absolutely right. And some of us will have seen that firsthand, some of us maybe will have even lived that firsthand. And the idea that the idea in our culture that you can't live without sex, in contrast to what this gentleman is saying, therefore people can rush into marriage because marriage is the place where there's, you know, loads of guilt-free sex. Yeah. I mean, put your hand up if you're married. You know, I won't ask you to keep your hand up if your marriage is full of guilt, loads of guilt-free sex. I won't ask you. But there is a bit of a danger, I think, in some Christians why is that heaven? Where it's almost as if marriage is oversold as being such an idyllic, wonderful thing where there is great sex, almost as if the sex is great as a reward for waiting. And it's not, and we all know life is not as simple as that, is it? You know, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't wait. It doesn't mean just go ahead, but it does mean, well, we need to be careful how we put that. You know, if we're going to say wait till marriage, you might say, well, even in marriage, that's no guarantee. It's not all sunshine, well, it is very important. What other potential pitfalls are there?
They feel like youngsters away from the church when they feel condemnation, have a relationship that isn't.
Yeah.
Especially like the university, will often.
Great example, yeah. If we. That's not an issue with the teaching as such, but if we portray it in a particular way, or if we respond to people who don't always live up to that ideal poorly, it will certainly drive people away. That's really important. Both gay, straight, and everything in between. You know, young unmarried woman shows up at church pregnant. I'm sure it didn't happen in God's, but there was a time when that would have been a difficult thing to do in, I don't mean she wouldn't show up pregnant, I mean that she would be received badly, as opposed to warmly welcomed. As far as I can tell, most churches have got the hang of that now. We realise the best way to help in this situation isn't to say, well, we shouldn't have done that, because it's a bit late. Every pregnant woman who, assuming it's an unintended pregnancy, who shows up at church, is making a hugely countercultural choice not to have secret abortion, actually. So, if anything, those people need, wow, good for you, what an amazing choice, how can we support you? Sorry, that's a different seminar. So yeah, some very important examples. So if we're too hard line or treat kind of deviations from the ideal as if they're the problem, that's going to be a serious problem.
It's reduced sexuality
from
the sexual act.
Okay, great. Sex is so much more than sex. That sounds weird, doesn't it? Yeah, being a sexual being, God made us male and female. That means we are all sexual beings in some sense, whether we have sex or not. This works out in two problematic ways. One problematic way is the idea that as soon as you get married, the sex is just happens. It's really easy and it's great from day one and all of those kinds of things. Whereas sex, just like any part of a relationship, requires time, requires work, requires care, and all of those kinds of things, just like communication, just like conflict. The other kind of challenge that it can produce is for people who don't have sex for whatever reason, you can almost send a message of you're not really living up to the full possibility of what it is to be human. And it's always a bit the church. Now, we expect that message to come from the world. You know, if you've seen the movie 40-Year-Old Virgin or heard the movie 40-Year-Old Virgin. You know, the whole premise of that, the title is there in the title. Oh, poor sad man, that he's 40 and he's never had sex. How pathetic. You know, you're invited to pity him. Because, as if there's something inherently fulfilling and humanising about sex. Whereas the reality is, we follow a man who never got married and never had sex. You know, sex isn't the be-all and end-all. Sure, it's nice, yes, okay. It's not, and it's not sinful and so on. But neither is it necessary fulfilment. Let's put it this way. I assume you think that Jesus was more fulfilled than you are. Now, what's the point of being? I mean, why are you all here on a Wednesday night? Very impressively. Unless you think, there's something about following Jesus, he's got something I haven't got yet. You know, even after all these years maybe of following him, there's still more, isn't there? So, you know, that is part one of, like, why you don't need to have sex to be fulfilled. Here's part two of why you don't need to have sex to be fulfilled. Do you remember Jesus said that in the new creation, we will neither marry nor be given in marriage. Sex is good, but it's temporary.
The good news is marriage is also temporary. That was a joke. It's not really. Okay, some of you are like, this isn't on divorce, but when Jesus comes back, we won't have sex. We won't be married, we won't have sex, and we won't mind. We won't miss it. We might unpack a little bit. A bit more of that later, but isn't that interesting? It's not necessary for Jesus' fulfillment. So these are all very important factors. If you do this teaching wrong, sex is good, it's for marriage, so wait for marriage. If you get that wrong, you could send these wrong messages. So, you know, I want to still say there's a lot in that basic teaching that's still good and true and helpful, but a lot of it is how we say it, how we frame it, what are the things we say alongside it. There's one thing that you haven't quite gotten onto yet, though. It might be because you all put up your hands up when I said, how many of you are married? Let me give you a hint. Sex is good, it's for marriage, so wait for marriage. Newsflash, not everyone gets married. Now, of course, when you're in your youth church, you don't really notice that, because most of the grown-ups that you know are married, you know, or at least have had sex to produce you, you know, at some point that happens. So, you know, but actually, the church is a place, especially if, you know, many churches would say, or many Christians would say, if you're a Christian, it's better if you're really... It's better on the whole if you marry another Christian, and so on. In most churches, the ratio of women to men is 2-1. So the math is not good in terms of assuming everyone's going to go along this path of meeting another Christian of the opposite sex, falling in love, and getting married. Sometimes it's the math that's the problem. Sometimes it's to do with sexual orientation, as it was in my case. But, yeah, for my money, that would be the biggest problem with this teaching was the assumption that everyone gets to have sex sooner or later, but that the main thing you need to get is patience. Rather than developing more of an idea of, as I've already been unpacking, you don't have to have sex to be fulfilled. You know, talking more positively about the value of that and how to do that well. Let me give you an example, just thinking more about singleness in the church. What do you do here for married people? What's the support like? What's the kind of the approach? Do you do a marriage course or marriage support, for example?
Yeah.
Okay. Marriage preparation, I'm sure, before people get married. Okay. Do you have a singleness course? You have
an author of a person in France.
An author of a person.
And we have a person who is an author who runs.
Oh, who runs singleness courses. Oh, I didn't even let me. Afterwards, please give me their name, because I'd love to hear. Oh, I'd love to hear more about that, because it's not often I get such a positive response. In most churches, there's a lot of intentional investment and support for marriage. Because guess what? And lots of you put your hand up about marriage. Good marriages don't just happen. They require preparation, ongoing support, and a lot of work. Here's the thing. Living well as a single person doesn't just happen either. It also requires preparation, ongoing support, and a lot of work. Whereas a lot of single people feel invisible in the church, a lot of the leaders tend to be married, and not necessarily that there is that intentional investment at the same level. There may well be good things happening at an informal level, but not always at the same intentional level in the church. So I think for me, going back to the story, that's a bit of a tangent, sorry about that, but got you talking, so that's positive. For me, I realised I was gay, but I had this clear teaching that sex was for marriage. Now, this was long before same-sex marriage, obviously, at this was 20 years ago. So for me, wait for marriage clearly wasn't going to work. For me, I started to think, well, it sounds like I'm just going to have to stay single. I'm not going to have sex. That sounds like that's the way that this is going to play out. By this point, I'd gone off to university, and at university, I was not many miles down the road from here, in fact. I started to be much more open about my sexuality. I hadn't felt confident enough to tell people I was gay at school and so on, but at university I was open about it, including within church. Now, I was very involved in the Christian Union. How many of you have been involved in the Christian Union in your time? Quite a few of you. If you have been, you will probably be aware they are not normally hotbeds of radical liberal theology. That normally raises the one I was part of at a university not very far away was no exception. It was a pretty standard, fairly conservative, traditional Christian kind of approach, which would very much go along with the view sex is for marriage only, and therefore if you are attracted to other guys, you need to not act on those.